This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Dan Hurley.
I did not do anything illegal. I did not do anything that was unethical. I did not do anything that was unwelcome or unwanted. And I did not engage in sexual harassment.
That was the voice of Kentucky State Representative Jeff Hoover, speaking on the floor of the House a year ago as he resigned as Speaker in response to charges of sexual harassment from a staffer. Revelations this week of exactly what that staffer testified to have resurrected the controversy and raised questions about Hoover's future, even though his constituents sent him back to the House in November. To explore these latest developments, we are joined from the Kentucky Center of Investigative Reporting, R.G. Dunlop, and the Kentucky Public Radio Capital Bureau Chief, Ryland Barton. If you would like to join the discussion, call 513-419-7100 or email us at talk@wvxu.org. We're also on Facebook and Twitter. R.G. and Ryland, welcome to Cincinnati Edition. Thank you for being here this afternoon.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Ryland, just to get started, you know, the issues around these charges have been known for some time in a general sense. It cost Jeff Hoover his position as Speaker, as we just heard a year ago. What happened to put this back on the front pages?
Well, we obtained a deposition that was taken in a totally separate lawsuit. It was a lawsuit from two of this woman's supervisors who are suing the Legislative Research Commission, which is kind of the agency, the state, the administrative arm of the legislature, alleging that they were retaliated against for reporting sexual harassment. In that lawsuit, they deposed this woman who had made sexual harassment allegations against former Speaker Hoover and a handful of other lawmakers, and so in that deposition, there are really it's our first account of this woman's rendition of what happened. So before that, all we had known is that former Speaker Hoover and these other lawmakers had made a secret settlement with this woman over we didn't know what. The only thing that we knew was former Speaker Hoover's perspective, which is that the only thing that happened was inappropriate text messaging. We now know, or we now have at least the woman's rendition of what happened, which is that there is a lot more. She said that she was, she puts it, sexually assaulted more than 50 times, that she was repeatedly groped, touched without her consent, and that this took place over the course of almost 2 years. In the State House while she was working for the House Republican Caucus.
Well, I want to get to some of those details here as we go along, but this is a person who the name has not been revealed, just the unnamed staffer or Jane Doe sometimes is the reference in some of the legal documents. I have to presume, RG, that given the fact that she played a role she worked on in the legislature for almost 2 years, that people who are around this case, you probably know who this person is. Am I correct? You're just respecting the fact that her name has not been revealed to the public and you're not doing that?
Well, the deposition is confidential and we don't talk about how we get information or where we got it. What we do know is what this individual said in this sworn statement, and what she said, as Ryland mentioned earlier, was pretty radically different than former Speaker Hoover's account of what transpired. She described very graphically numerous instances of inappropriate conduct, sexual assault type conduct toward her by Mr. Hoover and others.
You know, what you lay out in the article that both of you published is this, as Ryland was saying, 50 cases, which is an approximate number, of sexual assaults, almost daily touching, including when they were out in public in restaurants having herself touched under the table, that Hoover himself was incredibly jealous and possessive about her and didn't want her to interact with other men. I mean, this just goes on and on. This is not just a few isolated incidents. This is a pattern that seemed to be there almost right from the beginning. Is that right?
I think that is correct, and not only outside the workplace, but in the workplace as well, in elevators, in hallways, in other places. So this seemed, as Ms. Doe described it, an almost unrelenting barrage of unwanted sexual overtures toward her by Mr. Hoover, and less frequently by others.
Well, one of the things that was reported was that when she took the job, and by the way, your report says that she was 21 when she took the job in February of 2015. She was told by someone in the Republican caucus that part of her job was to make sure that she, and I quote here, keep Jeff Hoover happy. Now, you know, looking back on hindsight, when there's this kind of testimony, that all sounds really, but it's not necessarily clear, or it might not be clear, that whoever told her that was what was going to be intended, that there was this sexual side of her responsibilities. Now, what do you think about that, Ryland? I mean, was he just known that this was something that was going to have to be part of her job?
I think that really that comment is indicative of this larger culture in Frankfurt, especially among partisan staff. And certainly this isn't in every case, but it has happened throughout history. I mean, this is something that RG reported on back in 2013 with a Democratic lawmaker. In that case, there was a former Democratic representative, John Arnold, had inappropriately groped staffers and several other incidents. And this is just kind of, it was just part of, especially in a really male-dominated Capitol, that sexual joking and some of these inappropriate relationships and inappropriate touching, and it was just kind of it's part of what happens a lot of the times in Frankfurt, especially behind closed doors, and especially behind in these situations where especially partisan staffers, they are they're working for both political appointees and for elected representatives, and most of these young staffers want to continue having a job in politics, and so they're unwilling to go against the grain and to call out these people when they happen, and especially using the official channels to call out people. So a lot of these a lot of this behavior can go unchecked and can get out of hand, and I think that's certainly what this testimony speaks to.
Yeah, in that testimony, she repeatedly said, as you reported, that she, quote, I had no choice, that she was asked to do something was imposed on her. And repeatedly, when whoever was taking the deposition asked her, well, why didn't you stop it? Why didn't you report it? Why didn't you do something? The answer was, I had no choice. And I think it's important to remember, as you were just saying, she's young, she wants a career in politics, and this is where she starts, right?
Right, and I think that's kind of the crux of the problem here. It's if you want to continue to have your job, you better not report this. And I mean, I think that when you ask lawmakers or especially leaders in the legislature whether or not this is true, they say that there are avenues to report these things, that they can go to the administrative arm, the LRC, to report human resources violations. But then again, you have to think, all right, what's going to happen in that case? They could recommend a hearing, which we saw last year. The Legislative Ethics Commission reviewed some of the initial allegations that were brought up in this case. And what ended up happening was, Former Speaker Hoover admitted to exchanging inappropriate text messages with the woman. He was fined $1,000, and that was it. Ultimately, the worst thing that that commission can do, or the most stringent penalty that they can give out, is a recommendation that somebody be removed from the House. The House ends up having to vote on that. It's just a majority of vote on whether or not they should remove somebody. So ultimately, it becomes this political decision, and everything it gets really gummed up, and there's not a lot of, I'd imagine, you know, if you're a young staffer, you know, looking at that possibility before you, you would never want to do that because you know your career in politics would be over. I think that there's one really telling quote that this woman gives in the deposition. She says, "I absolutely loved my job I was doing and wanted to continue to work in politics. Filing a police report or taking any action would ruin any chance of advancing, and I think my life now is a perfect example of that." This is a woman who's, you know, she's unemployed now. Her goal of having a job in politics is totally on hold, and she can't really, because of this confidentiality agreement, she can't talk about this. Meanwhile, former Speaker Hoover has for the last year been able to give his side of the story, which is that it was only inappropriate text messaging. Meanwhile, this woman has not been able to say anything.
I think it's worth underlining, too, that Mr. Hoover was one of the most powerful people in state government. He was not just a fellow associate. He was not just your typical politician. He was a powerful politician. He wielded great influence, and I think she correctly observed that attempting to stand up with him would have dire consequences for her professionally going forward.
One of the interesting things that I found in this is it seems like her joining the Navy Reserve, if I understand this correctly, Naval Reserve, going away for some basic training while she was working at the legislature, at the General Assembly, that she came to understand that this kind of activity, one, could be reported in a different context. The Navy took harassment very seriously in a way, and that was part of what gave her courage to begin to stand up for herself. I find that very interesting, that different set of experience really helped her do something about this. I think what we're going to do is take a break. We're there anyway. After the break, RG and Ryland will return to discuss the political implications of these developments. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Dan Hurley. The new revelations about the actions of former Kentucky Speaker Jeff Hoover not only raised questions about his status, but about how the Republican Party handled the entire situation. To talk about the potential implications for the party, we are joined today by R.G. Dunlop with the Kentucky Center for Investigative Reporting and Kentucky Public Radio Capitol Bureau Chief Ryland Barton. If you'd like to join our discussion, you can call 513-419-7100 or email us at talk@wvxu.org. I think we lost both of you just before we took the break, but it came at the right moment. Good to have you back.
Thank you.
Hey, we're back.
Okay. Ryland, you were making the point that ultimately, or I don't know, maybe it was RG, making the point that this is ultimately handled any sort of punishment that goes to a member of the General Assembly, that it's handed out by the members themselves. It becomes a political act, in effect. And is there no independent organization that has a code of conduct and clear reporting that, you know, most organizations, whether it's corporations, not-for-profits, have worked a lot on in the last few years to get clarified?
Yeah, so right now how it works is that if a lawmaker or a staffer could make a complaint with the Legislative Ethics Commission against a sitting lawmaker, so that's a commission that is independent, and they review the allegations, and This is something that happened last year with this particular case. The commission was called to review a complaint made against these four lawmakers who had signed this secret sexual harassment agreement. And ultimately, the commission dismissed the complaint against three of the lawmakers. And then for Representative Hoover, he admitted to exchanging inappropriate text messages with the woman and being fined $1,000. The thing is that's the worst thing that they could do is they can publicly censure him and recommend that the House vote to dismiss him. So that's it. That's how it works right now. The other problem with this process now is that there's actually not even an explicit ban on sexual harassment in the legislature under these ethics rules that the House and Senate adopts. There's no ban on it. So in these last couple cases where lawmakers have been, I guess you'd call it prosecuted, but it's not really prosecution. They get prosecuted under this rule that of misusing their position or misusing their office. So it's unclear how, what the best way to do this is, but I think that certainly we have a few examples over the past few years of this process being being a little bit ineffective, that it's not able to really exact any kind of serious penalties against these lawmakers.
How many women are in the Kentucky House?
That's a good question. Rylan and I did the math before we prepared this story, and I don't remember the precise number. I'm sure he does, but it's fewer than one in five. I think, is it like 16%, Rylan, roughly?
I think it was 14%. I'll get that stat back up here in a sec.
But is there any trend, across the country, and certainly nationally, there has been a trend with an increased number of women. And if there was an increased number of women involved, it would seem to me that you would get more push behind some real reform that had some teeth in it.
And I think especially with these, these sexual harassment scandals, there's a continued push. Granted, after the last round of sexual harassment allegations back in 2013, the legislature mandated sexual harassment training that all lawmakers have to take at the beginning of every legislature. There have been reports since then, included also in this deposition, that lawmakers don't take those trainings very seriously. There's a lot of giggling that goes on, and lawmakers also say that it's just not, they already know this. They don't need to go through with it. Now, there have been proposals to try and strengthen the sexual harassment reporting process. Over the last couple of years, there have been bills filed by Republicans and Democrats, men and women, to, at this very basic level, make sexual harassment a behavior that is punishable by the Legislative Ethics Commission that can be reviewed. Again, I think that there are questions still whether that is enough. I think that there's questions as how should this really be reviewed? Is this something that should be kicked into the court system? Because right now there's not really any way that this ends up in the court system unless there are individual charges brought against lawmakers.
But even if that legislation wasn't enough, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, Rylan, but I think it went nowhere in last year's session.
Correct. Yeah, last year it didn't go anywhere. There, year before that as well. There's a couple new proposals this session, so we'll see what lawmakers do with it.
So the question really becomes here, what are the political implications? What pain is exerted? And Representative Hoover not only got reelected last November, he never even had an opponent either in the primary or in the general election, either from a Republican or a Democrat. I mean, that's a bad sign that somebody who lost the speakership when Republicans hadn't controlled the House for decades, their first speaker ends up having to resign and then doesn't get challenged, it seems to me.
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question for Democrats in that district and also Republicans in that district. But yeah, Hoover was totally unopposed, as was Michael Meredith, who's another representative named in these named in the deposition. Granted, he had a Democratic opponent. He just ended up winning that by a significant number. Politically, it's right now, I think that After our report, the state Republican Party and leaders in the legislature are still kind of sifting through what happened and trying to figure out what they know or who knew what. And they're kind of slow walking it at this point. I think that it will certainly be on them to figure out what to do with this, whether they will do anything with it. Also, we have to keep in mind, we haven't heard directly from Representative Hoover yet. We've heard from his lawyer, we haven't heard from the other lawmakers either. They'll be back, or at least Hoover and Meredith will be back in the legislature come the first week of February. So I think we are all eagerly awaiting to see what happens next.
Is Representative Hoover married?
Yes, he is.
And has his wife made any comment about any of this at any point?
There have been no. She didn't. I don't believe she made any public comments when this, when the report of the secret settlement last year first happened. And she certainly hasn't since our story came out earlier this week. But she was present during when he made his big speech just a little over a year ago on the House floor, stepping down from the speakership, and she was in the audience and she was there supporting her husband. And so she's in his speech, he said that she was sticking by him and that he had that actually it had again this previous our previous understanding of this scandal. That it had brought his family closer together, and they were standing by him.
Any implications here for the gubernatorial race? Because Republican State Representative Robert Goforth announced that he was going to run against Governor Bevin in a primary, and then there was a release of information of a woman claiming that Goforth had sexually assaulted her. So does this begin to have spillover impact?
Well, and that is, of course, a totally separate case from from the deposition and the accusations brought against these other lawmakers. Certainly, it also involves accusations of sexual assault. Just kind of dovetailing into that topic, I think that's something he has to answer to and has answered to. He denies those allegations. It's also worth noting that he's a newcomer to politics. He isn't incredibly well known across the state, so a challenge to Governor Bevin is already a pretty big long shot. Especially when there's other considerations of there might be other people getting into the race, other Republicans who might get into the race. Certainly. As it has for the last couple of years, sexual harassment and assault allegations are, these are things that men in power have to answer to now.
Okay.
And I think that that's a really important distinction now in our political environment.
Well, R.G. Dunlop and Rylan Barton, first, I want to congratulate you on your reporting. Secondly, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you
for having us.
Okay. WVXU would like to take note of the death earlier this week of Pamela Smitherman, the wife of Vice Mayor Christopher Smitherman, and the mother of their five children. We wish that Christopher, his children, and the extended Smitherman family find the strength not only to cope with Pamela's death, but to continue to contribute to the life of the city as a worthy tribute to their wife, mother, sister-in-law, and daughter-in-law. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Dan Hurley.
It's been such a long road for me, like, just having this opportunity to come in here, it's an overwhelming feeling, because we voted for this in 2016, and it's just been such a long road, and now we're here, and now I'm going to get help, and I'm going to go home and sleep later, and it's overwhelming. It's so great. I feel so blessed right now.
That was the voice of Delhi Township resident and Marine Corps veteran Alex Griffith, who returned from duty in Afghanistan with PTSD. Griffith drove 5 hours to be the second person in Ohio to purchase legal cannabis from an official state-approved dispensary. Four dispensaries opened their doors this week, 4 months late, to discuss the future of Ohio's medical marijuana program. We are joined today by Cincinnati Enquirer Columbus Bureau Chief Jackie Brochard and State House News Bureau reporter for Ohio Public Radio, Andy Chow. To join our discussion, you can call 513-419-7100 or email us at talk@wvxu.org. We're also on Facebook and Twitter. Jackie, Andy, welcome to Cincinnati Edition.
Hey, Dan.
Good afternoon.
Very good to have you here. You know, because the medical marijuana, Jackie, the program was, you know, 4 months late, getting started behind schedule. There was a lot of pent-up demand, people willing, like Mr. Griffith, to drive 5 hours to get what he needed. Has the state provided any information about sales either that first day or as this first week has gone forward?
Yeah, the State Board of Pharmacy, which oversees the dispensary part of the program, did release first-day sales numbers yesterday. Just very basically, the four dispensaries collectively sold 8.7 pounds of dried marijuana flower or bud for a total of $75,000. And that was those were the only figures that they made available. You know, some other, I think, things that would be important to know as the program moves ahead is how many patients are actually able to access dispensaries to buy marijuana and how much are they spending? You know, a per patient spend would let you know a little bit more about, you know, were people buying just one, you know, unit, you know, one container of marijuana to say that they bought the first on the first day, or were they buying really, you know, enough to last them, you know, longer, a couple weeks or so.
And Andy, what was the range of products available through these dispensaries this first week? And how does that range that exists right now relate to what ultimately is going to be out there?
I'm not quite sure exactly what the range of products were, but I know that there are just several varieties of product. Jackie was actually at the opening, but I think there are oils. And then, like she said, more than 8 pounds of bud were sold in over the course of 2 days. But what we can say is that this is the way it's used is limited. People are not allowed to smoke it, even though the way that the product is given to you, one can still smoke it, but they're not allowed to. So there's still some limitations here and there as far as how a patient can go about using the product.
Well, I'm confused. I'm confused.
They give you something that you can smoke if you were to figure out how to smoke it, but you're not allowed to smoke
it. What are you supposed to do with it?
You're supposed to vaporize it, and a vaporizer will heat the marijuana plant material to a temperature that is below burning. So, you know, medical studies have shown that vaporization seems to be gentler on the lungs, and because it does not actually introduce smoke. And, you know, I think when this law was being debated at the State House, a lot of legislators had a hard time with the idea of medical marijuana because this idea that you would smoke your medicine just seemed so bizarre and foreign to them. And that was the reason why they put in the law. They didn't allow smoking as a allowable form. They did allow plant material for vaporization. They allowed oils, tinctures, patches, edibles, edible products, infused brownies, chocolates, gummy candies, but they did not include combustion or smoking.
Well, Jackie, Andy mentioned that you were at the dispensaries, and in fact, you wrote a couple of articles based on being there that first day particularly. What was it like in the dispensaries?
So my colleague in Columbus, Jesse Ballmert, and I went to Wintersville, which was the site of two of the four dispensaries that were open on Wednesday. And we were actually allowed inside at CY Plus Dispensary to witness Alex, who you had on
right,
leading this segment, and another patient buying their first, you know, legal marijuana. And, you know, watching them, seeing them walk away from that counter holding the bag of stuff that they just bought. I mean, they just both looked so relieved. And, you know, Joan Kaliotis, who was the other patient, you know, she said she's been waiting a really, really, really long time. And, you know, Alex is younger and maybe not as long, but still they were just, you know, we asked them, what are you most looking forward to or excited about? And both of them said, I just want to sleep. I just want to, you know, be able to kind of function, and this will help me, and it's not pills, and it won't have the side effects. And then, you know, as they exited the dispensary, everybody who was waiting outside, there were probably about 30 to 50 people waiting outside in the cold, just cheering and giving hugs and high fives. And it was just a very, you know, jovial, happy place to be. And, you know, everyone standing in line there had a story of, you know, dealing with some sort of medical condition or prescription drugs that they had been taking that they didn't like or were giving them side effects or weren't working. And so just, you know, being able to talk to people who really had been looking forward to it and needing it, I think kind of put it in perspective that, you know, Ohio has really worked hard to make this a medical program. It's not going to look like what you see on the West Coast or in Colorado if you go out there and poke your head in a marijuana dispensary. And actually, members of the public will not be able to just walk into a dispensary and check it out. You have to be a registered patient or caregiver who's authorized to buy on behalf of a patient to be able to go inside.
Yeah, and just to give some more context to this, I mean, these people who are standing in line, these people who are watching this unfold, these are, some of them include advocates who have been fighting for this issue for more than 10 years now, for longer than 10 years. And even you go back to even talk to State Senator Kenny Yuko, when he was a representative here at the Ohio House, he would consistently bring up this measure over and over again in the General Assembly, pushing to legalize medicinal marijuana. And 10 years ago, when he first introduced it, it was sort of a fringe issue, a bonkers issue that would go nowhere because people thought it was just such a crazy idea to allow marijuana for medicinal use. And now you 10 years later, people are standing in line to go into these dispensaries, these pretty much what are pharmacies for marijuana. And we've just come a long way in 10 years.
Okay. In fact, we have a caller who's called in who I think has a question that relates to some of what both of you were just saying before. Larry, what is your question? Larry? Larry just went off. Larry was, if I read the question, the summary of the question, I think he was not happy with the process where you have to get certified in order to even be eligible to go into one of these dispensaries and have access to any of the products, and felt like that, I think, was too restrictive. I'm not quite sure.
If you look at it this way, I mean, you have to look at it like it's a prescribed medication. So you can't get your drugs from a pharmacy until you see a doctor, and then that medicine is prescribed to you. In this case, a doctor gives you a recommendation, and then that opens the door to allow you to go to one of these dispensaries, and then you become a patient at one of those dispensaries. So it is a pretty thorough, stringent process, but they're treating this, like Jackie said, they're treating this like a for medicinal purposes.
Okay, Larry is reconnected with us, and hopefully, Larry, what is your, maybe I tried to summarize what I thought your question was, but go ahead and ask it for yourself.
Sure, it just seems like a money grab to me because I don't pay for a card for any other medications, and I don't have $250 a year. It's not just one time that you get the card, it's every year. And it just doesn't seem fair that you're doing that.
Okay, so it's the price of the card that has to annually be renewed.
I see.
Oh, yeah, I think, right. And, you know, it is interesting because while the state has been treating it like it's a pharmaceutical drug that needs to not be prescribed because that would violate federal law, but recommended by physicians, but it's still not 100% there. And that's one of the, what Larry brought up, the cost. I mean, that's medical insurance, Medicare, Medicaid will not cover the cost of your medical marijuana. They will not cover the cost of your registration card, which is $50 a year in Ohio. It's half that for veterans. And it will not cover the costs usually of your doctor's visit, because there's only about 375 doctors in Ohio who have agreed to recommend medical marijuana. So chances are your primary care physician is not one of those. And so you'll have to go see a doctor who is special, who has chosen to kind of specialize in medical marijuana and write recommendations. And that office visit is most likely not covered by your health insurance. And that can, you know, doctors I've been seeing charging anywhere from $200 to, you know, $350 or $400 for that visit. And they all have different, you know, plans for payment or for doing that. But that's kind of been the standard in the other, you know, highly regulated medical marijuana states. And I've already seen some discussion, because I know the pricing on the first product that came out was seemed high to a lot of people, a lot of patients that I talked to on Wednesday. And, you know, there's already some talk that, you know, this highly regulated market, while, you know, it's very beneficial for patients who can afford it and patients who really need that kind of, you know, pharmaceutical grade, pesticide and mold free, you know, highly regulated product, that maybe a fuller, more open recreational market would kind of tear down some of those regulations. And so, you know, I think that that's kind of the background of this, is as Ohio is moving forward with this highly restrictive medical program, you know, recreational marijuana is probably a few years from away from coming back to the ballot here.
So, I mean, what the reality is, what you just laid out, is that these costs are going to be prohibitive for a lot of lower income people in terms of getting relief.
Absolutely. And, you know, some dispensaries will give discounts. Those have to be approved by state regulators. But I know already the one up in Sandusky, the Forest Sandusky, gives veterans a 20% discount. And I've seen in other states people give discounts for senior citizens or for children under 18. So that's, you know, that helps, but that's not, it's not on par necessarily with, you know, the experience I think people are used to, where you see a doctor and you get a prescription and you know, go to the pharmacy.
Yeah, and you got to remember that the whole process that we're talking about here is a process that was created by the Ohio General Assembly after a ballot issue failed a couple of years ago. And it was because that issue failed, the legislator said, we better put something into law on our own terms. And that's why you're seeing a process that a lot of people might say is a little more restrictive than they're used to, because there are so many different hoops to jump through. I've been talking to a couple of veterans and veterans groups who are saying, well, it's hard for them because a lot of veterans see doctors through the VA, and those VA doctors are not under the list of physicians who can recommend marijuana for PTSD. So if you're a veteran and you have PTSD, you have to seek out a physician who is certified under the program. And then if you have PTSD, then you have to sort of relive those moments again and go through that difficult experience to be diagnosed with PTSD through a certified physician. So that's just one of the many examples of different hoops that people have to jump through just to get this medication in the first place.
What about expansion of the system? Okay, the first four dispensaries opened. Where do we stand in terms of getting dispensaries opened in other parts of the state, especially in the southwest portion of the state?
So the state licensed 56 dispensaries initially, and they can add more as they determine that patient demand is there. And they kind of allotted them by region. So the idea is that no one part of the state will be like a dispensary desert, although that did happen in really northwest Ohio. So there's a couple dispensaries expect to come online in the next month or two. I think we'll see a lot more later in the spring. You know, it's kind of hard to, they were supposed to be up and running within 6 months of getting their license. But, you know, if you talk to anyone who's tried to open a business, you run into all sorts of different hurdles, from zoning problems to, you know, getting your inspections done on time. So, I mean, that will grow. And ideally, you know, right now there are 29 growers that have been licensed, and only 14 of them are actually able to plant and grow marijuana right now. So the product that was on shelves this week came from only about a handful of growers. So as more of those growers harvest their first crops and get it into dispensaries, the prices are expected to come down. The variety is supposed to come up. There were only about, I think, 8 to 10 different choices that patients had on Wednesday. And that's also expected to grow as the program kind of builds up. But this has happened in really every other medical marijuana state. Pennsylvania, actually, they started with just on their opening day of first sales ever was just one dispensary and six growers. So already, you know, Ohio's positioned to kind of ramp up pretty quickly.
Okay. So the whole supply chain has to get fully developed, and it's going to take a couple of months or number of months. So when you see that. Jackie and Andy, I want to thank you for joining us today. We've talked about this topic many times in the past 6 months or so, and at least we finally now have four dispensaries actually open. So thank you for your reporting. Thank you for being here today.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
On Wednesday, Marty Brenneman announced that after 46 years in the broadcast booth, he will retire at the end of this red season and sort of next fall. To reflect on the career of Hall of Fame announcer and the future of calling Reds games, we are joined now by Cincinnati Enquirer sports columnist Paul Dougherty, who was himself named the Ohio Sports Writer of the Year by the National Sports Media Association this week. So, Paul, welcome back to Cincinnati Edition, and congratulations.
Thank you, sir. My pleasure. I always enjoy coming on your program.
Well, it's great to have you here. So, what makes, before we get to Marty specifically, what makes a good play-by-play baseball announcer?
That's a great question. I think the ability not only to call a game but to tell stories. Not only the ability to call a game and tell stories but be able to pace it. I think baseball is both the easiest and hardest game to call. Easiest because it's so slow-paced, you have time to see what's in front of you and judge it and talk about it, which is not a luxury afforded, say, basketball. But hardest is there's a lot of dead time, a lot of time you've got to fill between pitches. And Marty's been able to do that pretty masterfully, I think, over his career.
You know, one of the things I think about is that at the Reds Hall of Fame, there's the announce booth, and that's absolutely my favorite spot. You know, going in there where you get to, it's Marty and Joe sets up what the situation is, and then you get to try to call the play, and then Marty comes on, and Marty and Joe come on, and you hear how they actually called it, and you realize, holy mackerel, this is really hard work to really bring this alive for a radio audience and help people understand what's really going on in front of them. I think it's pretty amazing, and it's a great experience for people to, I think it sort of humbles you when you think, oh, gee, I can talk about baseball.
Well, you sure have to be light on your feet, and you have to be into everything that's going on in front of you. There are no do-overs. You know, as a writer, I can sometimes have the luxury of pondering things, of looking at something and thinking about it for a while before I commit it to the laptop, but broadcasting is instantaneous. You have to be on it all the time, and you have to know what you're doing all the time, and if you don't, you're going to get embarrassed.
Yeah. What makes Marty distinctive of all the play-by-play baseball announcers that, you know, you have personal experience with? What makes him distinctive in your mind?
In my opinion, Marty's the only guy that is consistently allowed to speak his mind. And because of that, he never insults the listener's intelligence. He's employed by the club, and the club over the years, to its great credit, has given him big latitude to voice his opinion. And some listeners don't like that. I happen to like it. I don't need to be told how great things are when they really aren't that great. I want to know the truth, and I want to know if there's going to be an opinion. I want it to come from somebody who's been around for four decades with the same ball club, who knows the landscape, and is an intelligent guy, and can give it to me straight rather than tell me everything's wonderful when the club's 30 games out of first place. I think that's I think that's Marty's best attribute. Plus, I think, and this is not often mentioned, but he's very generous to his partners. He's had several over the years since Joe, and Marty allows them to do their thing. He's very good in terms of setting them up, making them look smart. And if you're a guy like Marty, you're in the Hall of Fame that goes forever, you don't have to do that. You know, you can act as if this is my booth. This is my show. And Marty has never done that, and the broadcasts have been better for it.
Yeah, you can really, being a color commentator is very different, and knowing how to balance those two roles, which Marty seems to do, as you say, set the person up, pick up from where it was ever left off to get back to the game. There's a real sort of rhythm there, a real sort of dance to all of that that I think is very interesting.
Well, absolutely. And I think that what you've seen for the last several years between Marty and Jeff Brantley has been broadcast poetry. I mean, seriously, it's interesting to me because I travel a lot and run a lot of cars. And even when we're traveling to vacation, Florida, wherever, we have the Sirius radio in the car. And so we listen to a lot of ball games, and you listen to the announcers, and they simply aren't as good as these guys here. And it's amazing to me sometimes when people are critical of Marty. It says to me that most of the people that are critical haven't been to other places or listened to other broadcasters, because they're really, now that Vin Scully is retired, they're really on a whole lot of people in Marty's league.
How do the Reds go about finding the next play-by-play announcer? And they've got to be thinking about this right now. What happens this season? How do they approach this?
Well, they're bringing in a guy, Tommy Thrall, who was the play-by-play guy for the Blue Wasps, Pensacola, the Reds' AA affiliate. He's going to work 60 or 70 games, is my understanding. He'll be in the booth. He's going to do the post-game show, and it's a bit of an audition for Tommy. He did a weekend last summer. People probably don't remember. I think it was in August. And I listened to him. I thought he was very good. It's not Marty, but that's not fair even to compare him. I think they'll start with him. I know that it's sort of like an athletic director in a college who knows his coach is going to leave sooner or later and compiles a file of replacements. I think the Reds have done that over the last several years, knowing that at some point Marty was going to leave, and we've got these guys in the upper right-hand drawer here, and when Marty leaves, we're at least a little bit prepared.
One quick question before we run out of time. What about Tom Brenneman?
I don't think Tom wants to do it.
Okay.
He's not a full-time radio guy. He still has relatively young kids. He doesn't want to spend his entire summer on the road. I think he likes what he's doing now.
Well, Paul Dougherty, thank you for joining us today. It's always great to have you on the Cincinnati Edition. You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. The producer for today's show is Pete Reitmeier. The assistant producer is Selena Reeder. The technical director is Josh Elstrow. Archives of our program are available on the website, wvxu.org. I'm Dan Hurley.